shouted as he drew abreast of Edric and the other survivors. To me! In front of him, arrows continued to rain down upon the mass of soldiers, forcing them to cover themselves with their shields, while at the same time trying to fend off the Varden's swords and spears. Once he and his warriors had surrounded the Varden who were on foot, Roran shouted, Back! Back! To the houses! Step by step, the lot of them withdrew until they were out of reach of the soldiers' blades, and then they turned and ran toward the nearest house. The soldiers shot and killed three of the Varden along the way, but the rest arrived at the building unharmed. Edric slumped against the side of the house, gasping for breath. When again he was able to speak, he gestured at Roran's men and said, Your intervention is most timely and welcome, Stronghammer. But why do I see you here, and not riding out from among the soldiers, as I expected? Then Roran explained what he had done, and pointed out the archers on the roofs. A dark scowl appeared on Edric's brow as he listened to Roran's account. However, he did not chastise Roran for his disobedience, but merely said, Have those men come down at once. They have succeeded in breaking the soldiers' discipline. Now we must rely upon honest blade work to dispose of them. There are too few of us left to attack the soldiers directly, protested Roran. They outnumber us better than 3-1. Then we shall make up in valour what we lack in numbers, Edric bellowed. I was told you had courage, Stronghammer, but obviously rumour is mistaken and you are as timid as a frightened rabbit. Now do as you're told, and do not question me again. The captain indicated one of Roran's warriors. You there, lend me your steed. After the man dismounted, Edric pulled himself into the saddle and said, Half of you on horse, follow me. I go to reinforce Sand. Everyone else remain with Roran. Kicking his mount in the sides, Edric galloped away with the men who chose to follow him, racing from building to building as they worked their way around the soldiers clumped in the center of the village. Roran shook with fury as he watched them depart. Never before had he allowed anyone to question his courage without answering his critic with words or blows. So long as the battle persisted, however, it would be inappropriate for him to confront Edric. Very well, Roran thought. I shall demonstrate to Edric the courage he thinks I lack, but that is all he shall have from me. I will not send the archers to fight the soldiers face to face when they are safer and more effective where they are. Roran turned and inspected the men Edric had left to him. Among those they had rescued, Roran was delighted to see Karn, who was scratched and bloody, but on the whole unharmed. They nodded to each other, and then Roran addressed the group. You have heard what Edric said. I disagree. If we do as he wishes, all of us will end up piled in a cairn before sunset. We can still win this battle, but not by marching to our own deaths. What we lack in numbers, we can make up with cunning. You know how I came to join the Varden. You know I have fought and defeated the Empire before, and in just such a village. This I can do, I swear to you. But I cannot do it alone. Will you follow me? Think carefully. I will claim responsibility for ignoring Edric's orders. But he and Nasuada may still punish everyone who is involved. Then they would be fools, growled Karn. Would they prefer that we died here? No, I think not. You may count on me, Roran. As Karn made his declaration, Roran saw how the other men squared their shoulders and set their jaws, and how their eyes burned with renewed determination, and he knew they had decided to cast their lot with him, if only because they would not want to be parted from the only magician in their company. Many was the warrior of the Varden who owed his life to a member of Duvrangar Gutta, and the men-at-arms Roran had met would sooner stab themselves in a foot than go into battle without a spellcaster close at hand. Aye, said Harald. You may count on us as well, Stronghammer. Then follow me, said Roran. Reaching down, he pulled Karn up onto Snowfire, behind himself, then hurried with his group back around the village to where the bowmen on the roofs continued to fire arrows at the soldiers. as Roran and the men with him dashed from house to house, quarrels buzzed past them, sounding like giant angry insects, and one even buried itself halfway through Harald's shield. Once they were safely behind cover, Roran had the men who were still mounted give their bows and arrows to the men on foot, whom he then sent to climb the houses and join the other archers. As they scrambled to obey him, Roran beckoned to Khan, who had jumped off Snowfire the moment they ceased moving, and said, "I need a spell of you. Can you shield me and 10 others from these bolts?" Khan hesitated. "For how long? A minute, an hour, who knows? Shielding that many people from more than a handful of bolts would soon exceed the bounds of my strength. Although if you don't care if I stop the bolts in their tracks, I could deflect them from you, which..." "That would be fine. Who exactly do you want me to protect?" Roran pointed at the men he had picked to join him, and Khan asked each of them their names. Standing with his shoulders hunched inward, Khan began to mutter in the ancient language, his face pale and strained. 3 times he tried to cast the spell, and 3 times he failed. "I'm sorry," he said, and released an unsteady breath. "I can't seem to concentrate."
"Blast it, don't apologize," growled Roran. "Just do it."
Leaping down from Snowfire, he grasped Khan on either side of his head, holding him in place.
"Look at me. Look into the center of my eyes. That's it. Keep staring at me."
"Good.
Now, place the ward around us."
Khan's features cleared and his shoulders loosened, and then, in a confident voice, he recited the incantation. As he uttered the last word, he sagged slightly in Roran's grip before recovering.
"It is done," he said.
Roran patted him on the shoulder, then clambered into Snowfire's saddle again. Sweeping his gaze over the 10 horsemen, he said, "Guard my sides and my back, but otherwise keep behind me, so long as I am able to swing my hammer."
"Yes, sir."
"Remember, the bolts cannot harm you now. Khan, you stay here. Don't move too much. Conserve your strength. If you feel like you can't maintain the spell any longer, signal us before you end it. Agreed?" Khan sat on the front step of the house and nodded.
"Agreed."
Renewing his grip on his shield and hammer, Roran took a deep breath, attempting to calm himself.
"Brace yourselves," he said,
and clucked his tongue to Snowfire. With the 10 horsemen following, Roran rode out into the middle of the dirt street that ran between the houses and faced the soldiers once more. 500 or so of Galbatorix's troops remained in the center of the village, most of them crouching or kneeling behind their shields while they struggled to reload their crossbows. Occasionally, a soldier would stand and loose a bolt at one of the archers on the roofs before dropping back behind his shield as a flight of arrows sliced through the air where he had just been. Throughout the corpse-strewn clearing, patches of arrows studded the ground, like reeds sprouting from the bloody soil. Several hundred feet away, on the far side of the soldiers, Roran could see a knot of thrashing bodies, and he assumed that was where Sand, Edric, and whatever remained of their forces were fighting the soldiers. If the young woman and the boy were still in the clearing, he did not notice them. A quarrel buzzed toward Roran. When the bolt was less than a yard from his chest, it abruptly changed direction and hurtled off at an angle, missing him and his men. Roran flinched, but the missile was already past. His throat constricted, and his heartbeat doubled. Glancing around, Roran spotted a broken wagon leaning against a house off to his left. He pointed at it and said, "Pull that over here, and lay it upside down. Block as much of the street as you can." To the archers, he shouted, "Don't let the soldiers sneak around and attack us from the sides. When they come at us, thin out their ranks as much as you can. And as soon as you run out of arrows, come join us."
"Yes, sir."
"Just be careful you don't shoot us by accident, or I swear I'll haunt your halls for the rest of time."
"Yes, sir."
More quarrels flew at Roran and the other horsemen in the street, but in every case, the bolts glanced off Khan's ward and veered into a wall or the ground or vanished into the sky. Roran watched his men drag the wagon into the street. When they were nearly finished, he lifted his chin, filled his lungs, and then, projecting his voice toward the soldiers, he roared,
"Ho there, you cowering carrion dogs! See how only 11 of us bar your way! Win past us, and you win your freedom! Try your hand if you have the guts! What? You hesitate? Where is your manhood, you deformed maggots, you bilious swine-faced murderers? Your fathers were dribbling half-wits who should have been drowned at birth. Aye, and your mothers were poxy trollops and the consorts of Urghals."
Roran smiled with satisfaction as several of the soldiers howled with outrage and began to insult him in return. One of the soldiers, however, seemed to lose his will to continue fighting, for he sprang to his feet and ran northward, covering himself with his shield and darting from side to side in a desperate attempt to avoid the archers. Despite his efforts, the Vardan shot him dead before he had gone more than 100 feet.
"Ha!" exclaimed Roran. "Cowards you are, every last one of you, you verminous river rats! If it will give you spine, then know this. Roran Stronghammer is my name, and Aragorn Shadeslayer is my cousin. Kill me, and that foul king of yours will reward you with an earldom or more. But you will have to kill me with a blade. Your crossbows are of no use against me. Come now, you slugs, you leeches, you starving white-bellied ticks! Come and best me if you can!"
With a flurry of battle cries, a group of 30 soldiers dropped their crossbows, drew their flashing swords, and with shields held high, ran toward Roran and his men. From over his right shoulder, Roran heard Harold say,
"Sir, there are many more of them than us."
"Aye," Roran said, keeping his eyes fixed on the approaching soldiers. 4 of them stumbled and then lay motionless on the ground, pierced through by numerous shafts.
"If they all charge us at once, we won't stand a chance."
"Yes, but they won't. Look, they're confused and disorganized. Their commander must have fallen. As long as we maintain order, they cannot overwhelm us."
"But Stronghammer, we cannot kill that many men ourselves."
Roran glanced back at Harold.
"Of course we can. We fight to protect our families and to reclaim our homes and our lands. They fight because Galbatorix forces them to. They have not the heart for this battle. So think of your families, think of your homes, and remember it is they you are defending. A man who fights for something greater than himself may kill 100 enemies with ease."
As he spoke, Roran saw in his mind an image of Katrina clad in her blue wedding dress, and he smelled the scent of her skin, and he heard the muted tones of her voice from their discussions late at night.
"Katrina!"
Then the soldiers were upon them, and for a span Roran heard nothing but the thud of swords bouncing off his shield and the clang of his hammer as he struck the soldiers' helms, and the cries of the soldiers as they crumpled underneath his blows. The soldiers threw themselves against him with desperate strength, but they were no match for him or his men. When he vanquished the last of the attacking soldiers, Roran burst out laughing, exhilarated. What a joy it was to crush those who would harm his wife and his unborn child! He was pleased to see that none of his warriors had been seriously injured. He also noticed that during the fray several of the archers had descended from the roofs to fight on horseback with them. Roran grinned at the newcomers and said,
"Welcome to the battle."
"A warm welcome indeed," one of them replied. Pointing with his gore-covered hammer toward the right side of the street, Roran said,
You, and you, pile the bodies over there. Make a funnel out of them and the wagon, so that only 2 or 3 soldiers can get to us at once."
"Yes, sir,"
the warriors answered, swinging down from their horses. A quarrel whizzed toward Roran. He ignored it and focused on the main body of soldiers, where a group, perhaps 100 strong, was massing in preparation for a second onslaught.
"Hurry!"
he shouted to the men shifting the corpses.
"They're almost upon us! Harold, go help!"
Roran wet his lips, nervous, as he watched his men labour while the soldiers advanced. To his relief, the four Varden dragged the last body into place and clambered back onto their steeds moments before the wave of soldiers struck. The houses on either side of the street, as well as the overturned wagon and the gruesome barricade of human remains, slowed and compressed the flow of soldiers until they were nearly at a standstill when they reached Roran. The soldiers were packed so tightly they were helpless to escape the arrows that streaked toward them from above. The first two ranks of soldiers carried spears, with which they menaced Roran and the other Varden. Roran parried three separate thrusts, cursing the whole while as he realized that he could not reach past the spears with his hammer. Then a soldier stabbed Snowfire in the shoulder, and Roran leaned forward to keep from being thrown, as the stallion squealed and reared. As Snowfire landed on all fours, Roran slid out of the saddle, keeping the stallion between him and the hedge of spear-wielding soldiers. Snowfire bucked as another spear pierced his hide. Before the soldiers could wound him again, Roran pulled on Snowfire's reins and forced him to prance backward until there was enough room among the other horses for the stallion to turn around. "Yah!" he shouted, and slapped Snowfire on the rump, sending him galloping out of the village.
"Make way!"
Roran bellowed, waving at the Varden. They cleared a path for him between their steeds, and he bounded to the forefront of the fight again, sticking his hammer through his belt as he did. A soldier jabbed a spear at Roran's chest. He blocked it with his wrist, bruising himself on the hard wooden shaft, and then yanked the spear out of the soldier's hands. The man fell flat on his face. Twirling the weapon, Roran stabbed the man, then lunged forward and lanced two more soldiers. Roran took a wide stance, planting his feet firmly in the rich soil where once he would have sought to raise crops, and shook the spear at his foes, shouting,
"Come, you misbegotten bastards! Kill me if you can! I am Roran Stronghammer, and I fear no man alive!"
The soldiers shuffled forward, three men stepping over the bodies of their former comrades to exchange blows with Roran. Dancing to the side, Roran drove his spear into the jaw of the rightmost soldier, shattering his teeth. A pennant of blood trailed the blade as Roran withdrew the weapon, and dropping to one knee, impaled the central soldier through an armpit. An impact jarred Roran's left shoulder. His shield seemed to double in weight. Rising, he saw a spear buried in the oak planks of his shield, and the remaining soldier of the trio rushing at him with a drawn sword. Roran lifted his spear above his head, as if he were about to throw it, and when the soldier faltered, kicked him between the fork of his legs. He dispatched the man with a single blow. During the momentary lull in combat that followed, Roran disengaged his arm from the useless shield and cast it and the attached spear under the feet of his enemies, hoping to tangle their legs. More soldiers shuffled forward, quailing before Roran's feral grin and stabbing spear. A mound of bodies grew before him. When it reached the height of his waist, Roran bounded to the top of the blood-soaked berm, and there he remained, despite the treacherous footing, for the height gave him an advantage. Since the soldiers were forced to climb up a ramp of corpses to reach him, he was able to kill many of them when they stumbled over an arm or a leg, or stepped upon the soft neck of one of their predecessors, or slipped on a slanting shield. From his elevated position, Roran could see that the rest of the soldiers had chosen to join the assault, save for a score across the village who were still battling Sands and Edric's warriors. He realized he would have no more rest until the battle had concluded. Roran acquired dozens of wounds as the day wore on. Many of his injuries were minor, a cut on the inside of a forearm, a broken finger, a scratch across his ribs where a dagger had shorn through his mail. But others were not. From where he lay on the pile of bodies, A soldier stabbed Roran through his right calf muscle, hobbling him. Soon afterward, a heavy-set man, smelling of onions and cheese, fell against Roran, and with his dying breath, shoved the bolt of a crossbow into Roran's left shoulder, which thereafter prevented Roran from lifting his arm overhead. Roran left the bolt embedded in his flesh, for he knew he might bleed to death if he pulled it out. Pain became Roran's ruling sensation. Every movement caused him fresh agony, but to stand still was to die, and so he kept dealing death blows, regardless of his wounds and regardless of his weariness. Roran was sometimes aware of the Varden behind or beside him, such as when they threw a spear past him, or when the blade of a sword would dart around his shoulder to fell a soldier who was about to brain him, but for the most part Roran faced the soldiers alone, because of the pile of bodies he stood on, and the restricted amount of space between the overturned wagon and the sides of the houses. Above, the archers who still had arrows maintained their lethal barrage, their grey goose shafts penetrating bone and sinew alike. Late in the battle, Roran thrust his spear at a soldier, and as the tip struck the man's armour, the haft cracked and split along its length. That he was still alive seemed to catch the soldier by surprise, for he hesitated before swinging his sword in retaliation. His imprudent delay allowed Roran to duck underneath the length of singing steel and seize another spear from the ground, with which he slew the soldier. To Roran's dismay and disgust, the second spear lasted less than a minute before it too shattered in his grip. Throwing the splintered remains at the soldiers, Roran took a shield from a corpse and drew his hammer from his belt. His hammer, at least, had never failed him. Exhaustion proved to be Roran's greatest adversary. As the last of the soldiers gradually approached, each man waiting his turn to duel him. Roran's limbs felt heavy and lifeless, his vision flickered and he could not seem to get enough air, and yet he somehow always managed to summon the energy to defeat his next opponent. As his reflexes slowed, the soldiers dealt him numerous cuts and bruises that he could have easily avoided earlier. When gaps appeared between the soldiers, and through them Roran could see open space, he knew his ordeal was nearly at an end. He did not offer the final 12 men mercy, nor did they ask it of him, even though they could not have hoped to battle their way past him, as well as the Varden beyond. Nor did they attempt to flee. Instead, they rushed at him, snarling, cursing, desiring only to kill the man who had slain so many of their comrades, before they too passed into the void. In a way, Roran admired their courage. Arrows sprouted from the chests of 4 of the men, downing them. A spear thrown from somewhere behind Roran took a 5th man under the collarbone, and he too toppled onto a bed of corpses. 2 more spears claimed their victims, and then the men reached Roran. The lead soldier hewed at Roran with a spiked axe. Although Roran could feel the head of the crossbow bolt grating against his bone, he threw up his left arm and blocked the axe with his shield. Howling with pain and anger as well as an overwhelming desire for the battle to end, Roran whipped his hammer around and slew the soldier with a blow to the head. Without pause, Roran hopped forward on his good leg and struck the next soldier twice in the chest before he could defend himself, cracking his ribs. The 3rd man parried 2 of Roran's attacks, but then Roran deceived him with a feint and slew him as well. The final 2 soldiers converged on Roran from either side, swinging at his ankles as they climbed to the summit of the piled corpses. His strength flagging, Roran sparred with them for a long and wearisome while, both giving and receiving wounds, until at last he killed one man by caving in his helm, and the other by breaking his neck with a well-placed blow. Roran swayed, and then collapsed. He felt himself being lifted up, and opened his eyes to see Harold holding a wineskin to his lips. "Drink this," Harold said. "You'll feel better." his chest heaving, Roran consumed several draughts between gasps. The sun-warmed wine stung the inside of his battered mouth. He felt his legs steady and said, "It's all right. You can let go of me now." Roran leaned against his hammer and surveyed the battleground. For the first time he appreciated how high the mound of bodies had grown. He and his companion stood at least 20 feet in the air, which was nearly level with the tops of the houses on either side. Roran saw that most of the soldiers had died of arrows, but even so he knew that he had slain a vast number by himself.
How many?
He asked Harold. The blood-spattered warrior shook his head.
I lost count after 32. Perhaps another can say. What you did, Stronghammer. Never have I seen such a feat before, not by a man of human abilities. The dragon Saphira chose well. The men of your family are fighters like no others. Your prowess is unmatched by any mortal, Stronghammer. However many you slew here today,
It was 193! Cried Khan, clambering toward them from below.
Are you sure?
Asked Roran, unbelieving. Khan nodded as he reached them.
I watched, and I kept careful count. 193 it was. 94 if you count the man you stabbed through the gut before the archers finished him off.
The tally astounded Roran. He had not suspected the total was quite so large. A hoarse chuckle escaped him.
A pity there are no more of them. Another 7, and I would have an even 200.
The other men laughed as well. His thin face furrowed with concern, Khan reached for the bolt sticking out of Roran's left shoulder, saying,
Here, let me see to your wounds.
No,
said Roran and brushed him away.
There may be others who are more seriously injured than I am. Tend to them first.
Roran, several of those cuts could prove fatal unless I stanched the bleeding. It won't take but a...
I'm fine, he growled. Leave me alone.
Roran, just look at yourself.
He did, and averted his gaze.
Be quick about it, then.
Roran stared into the featureless sky, his mind empty of thought, while Khan pulled the bolt out of his shoulder and muttered various spells. In every spot where the magic took effect, Roran felt his skin itch and crawl, followed by a blessed cessation of pain. When Khan had finished, Roran still hurt, but he did not hurt quite so badly, and his mind was clearer than before. The healing left Khan grey-faced and shaking. He leaned against his knees until his tremors stopped.
I will go, he paused for breath. Go, help the rest of the wounded now.
He straightened and picked his way down the mound, lurching from side to side as if he were drunk. Roran watched him go, concerned. Then it occurred to him to wonder about the fate of the rest of their expedition. He looked toward the far side of the village and saw nothing but scattered bodies, some clad in the red of the Empire, others in the brown wool favoured by the Varden.
What of Edric and Sand? He asked Harold.
I'm sorry, Stronghammer, but I saw nothing beyond the reach of my sword.
Calling to the few men who still stood on the roofs of the houses, Roran asked,
What of Edric and Sand?
We do not know, Stronghammer,
they replied. Steadying himself with his hammer, Roran slowly picked his way down the tumbled ramp of bodies, and with Harold and 3 other men by his side, crossed the clearing in the center of the village, executing every soldier they found still alive. When they arrived at the edge of the clearing, where the number of slain Varden surpassed the number of slain soldiers, Harold banged his sword on his shield and shouted,
Is anyone still alive?
After a moment, a voice came back at them from among the houses.
Name yourself!
Harold, and Roran Stronghammer, and others of the Varden! If you serve the Empire, then surrender, for your comrades are dead, and you cannot defeat us!
From somewhere between the houses came a crash of falling metal, and then, in ones and twos, Warriors of the Varden emerged from hiding and limped toward the clearing, many of them supporting their wounded comrades. They appeared dazed, and some were stained with so much blood, Roran at first mistook them for captured soldiers. He counted 24 men. Among the final group of stragglers was Edric, helping along a man who had lost his right arm during the fighting. Roran motioned, and two of his men hurried to relieve Edric of his burden. The captain straightened from under the weight. With slow steps, he walked over to Roran and looked him straight in the eye, his expression unreadable. Neither he nor Roran moved, and Roran was aware that the clearing had grown exceptionally quiet. Edric was the first to speak. "How many of your men survived?"
"Most. Not all, but most."
Edric nodded.
"And Khan?"
"He lives. What of Sand?"
"A soldier shot him during his charge. He died but a few minutes ago."
Edric looked past Roran, then toward the mound of bodies.
"You defied my orders, Stronghammer."
"I did."
Edric held out an open hand toward him.
"Captain, no!" exclaimed Harold, stepping forward. "If it weren't for Roran, none of us would be standing here. And you should have seen what he did. He slew nearly 200 by himself."
Harold's pleas made no impression on Edric, who continued to hold out his hand. Roran remained impassive as well. Turning to him then, Harold said,
"Roran, you know the men are yours. Just say the word and we will—"
Roran silenced him with a glare.
"Don't be a fool."
Between thin lips, Edric said,
"At least you're not completely devoid of sense. Harold, keep your teeth shut unless you want to lead the pack horses the whole way back."
Lifting his hammer, Roran handed it to Edric. Then he unbuckled his belt, upon which hung his sword and his dagger, and those too he surrendered to Edric.
"I have no other weapons," he said.
Edric nodded, grim, and slung the sword belt over one shoulder.
"Roran Stronghammer, I hereby relieve you of command. Have I your word of honour you will not attempt to flee?"
"You do."
"Then you will make yourself useful where you may, but in all else you will comport yourself as a prisoner."
Edric looked around and pointed at another warrior.
"Fuller, you will assume Roran's position until we return to the main body of the Varden, and Nasuada can decide what is to be done about this."
"Yes, sir,"
said Fuller.
For several hours Roran bent his back alongside the other warriors as they collected their dead and buried them on the outskirts of the village. During the process, Roran learned that only 9 of his 81 warriors had died in the battle, while between them Edric and Sand had lost almost 150 men, and Edric would have lost more except that a handful of his warriors had remained with Roran after he rode to their rescue. When they finished interring their casualties, the Varden retrieved their arrows, then built a pyre in the center of the village, stripped the soldiers of their gear, dragged them onto the pile of wood, and set it ablaze. The burning bodies filled the sky with a pillar of greasy black smoke that drifted upward for what seemed like miles. Through it, the sun appeared as a flat red disk. The young woman and the boy the soldiers had captured were nowhere to be found. Since their bodies were not among the dead, Roran guessed the two had fled the village when the fighting broke out, which he thought was probably the best thing they could have done. He wished them luck wherever they had gone. To Roran's pleased surprise, Snowfire trotted back into the village minutes before the Varden were to depart. At first the stallion was skittish and standoffish, allowing no one to approach, but by talking to him in a low voice, Roran managed to calm the stallion enough to clean and bandage the wounds in the horse's shoulder. Since it would be unwise to ride Snowfire until he was fully healed, Roran tied him to the front of the pack horses, which the stallion took an immediate dislike to, flattening his ears, flicking his tail from side to side, and curling his lips to bare his teeth.
"Behave yourself,"
said Roran, stroking his neck. Snowfire rolled an eyeball at him and nickered, his ears relaxing slightly. Then Roran pulled himself onto a gelding that had belonged to one of the dead Varden, and took his place at the rear of the line of men assembled between the houses. Roran ignored the many glances they directed at him, although it heartened him when several of the warriors murmured, "Well done." As he sat waiting for Edric to give the command to start forward, Roran thought of Nasawada and Katrina and Aragorn, and a cloud of dread shadowed his thoughts as he wondered how they would react when they learned of his mutiny. Roran pushed away his worries a second later. "I did what was right and necessary," he told himself. "I won't regret it, no matter what may come of it."
"Move on out!" shouted Edric from the head of the procession.
Roran spurred his steed into a brisk walk, and as one, he and the other men rode west, away from the village, leaving the pile of soldiers to burn itself to extinction. Message in a Mirror. The morning sun beat down on Saphira, suffusing her with a pleasant warmth. She lay basking on a smooth shelf of stone, several feet above Aragorn's empty cloth-shell tent. The night's activities, flying around scouting the Empire's locations as she had every night since Nasawada sent Aragorn to the big hollow mountain Farthendur, had left her drowsy. The flights were necessary to conceal Aragorn's absence, but the routine wore on her, for while the dark held no terrors for her, she was not nocturnal by habit, and she disliked having to do anything with such regularity. Also, since it took the Varden so long to move from place to place, she spent most of her time soaring over much the same landscape every night. The only recent excitement was when she spotted Stunted Thought's Red Scale's Thorn, low on the northeastern horizon the previous morning. He had not turned to confront her, however, but had continued on his way, heading deeper into the Empire. When Saphira had reported what she had seen, Nasawada, Arya, and the elves guarding Saphira had reacted like a flock of frightened jays, screaming and yammering at each other while darting every which way. They had even insisted that black-blue wolf-hair Blodgarm fly with her in the guise of Aragorn, which of course she had refused to allow. It was one thing to permit the elf to place a water-shadow ghost of Aragorn on her back every time she took off from or landed among the Varden, but she was not about to let anyone other than Aragorn ride her, unless a battle was imminent, and perhaps not even then. Saphira yawned and stretched out her right foreleg, spreading the clawed fingers of her paw. Relaxing again, she wrapped her tail around her body and adjusted the position of her head on her paws, visions of deer and other prey drifting through her mind. Not long afterward, she heard the patter of feet as someone ran through the camp heading toward Nasawada's folded-wing red butterfly chrysalis tent. Saphira paid little attention to the sound. Messengers were always hurrying to and fro. Just as she was about to fall asleep, Saphira heard another runner dash past, then after a brief interval, two more. Without opening her eyes, she extended the tip of her tongue and tasted the air. She detected no unusual odors. Deciding that the disturbance was not worth investigating, she drifted off into dreams of diving for fish in a cool green lake. Angry shouting woke Saphira. She did not stir as she listened to a large number of round-ear two-legs arguing with each other. They were too far away for her to make out the words, but from the tone of their voices she could tell they were angry enough to kill. Disputes sometimes broke out among the Varden just as they did in any large herd. But never before had she heard so many two-legs argue for so long, and with so much passion. A dull throbbing formed at the base of Saphira's skull as the two-leg shouting intensified. She tightened her claws against the stone beneath her, and with sharp cracks, thin wafers of the quartz-laden rock flaked off around the tips of her talons.
I shall count to 33, she thought, and if they have not stopped by then, they had better hope that whatever upset them was worth disrupting the rest of a daughter of the wind.
When Sapphira reached the count of 27, the two legs fell silent.
At last.
Shifting to a more comfortable position, she prepared to resume her much-needed slumber. Metal clinked. Plant cloth hides swished. Skin pore covering studded against the ground, and the unmistakable scent of dark-skinned warrior Nasuwada wafted over Sapphira.
What now?
She wondered, and briefly considered roaring at everyone until they fled in terror and left her alone. Sapphira opened a single eye and saw Nasuwada and her six guards striding toward where she lay. At the lower end of the slab of stone, Nasuwada ordered her guards to remain behind, with Blodgarm and the other elves, who were sparring with each other on a small expanse of grass, and then she climbed the slab by herself.
"Greetings, Sapphira," Nasuwada said.
She wore a red dress, and the color seemed unnaturally strong against the green leaves of the apple trees behind her. Glints of light from Sapphira's scales mottled her face. Sapphira blinked once, feeling no inclination to answer with words. After glancing around, Nasuwada stepped closer to Sapphira's head and whispered,
"Sapphira, I must speak to you in private. You can reach into my mind, but I cannot reach into yours. Can you remain inside me so I can think what I need to say and you will hear?"
Extending herself toward the woman's tense, hard, tired consciousness, Sapphira allowed her irritation at being kept from her sleep to wash over Nasuwada, and then she said,
"I can if I so choose, but I would never do so without your permission."
"Of course," Nasuwada replied, "I understand."
At first, Sapphira received nothing but disjointed images and emotions from the woman. A gallows with an empty noose, blood on the ground, snarling faces, dread, weariness, and an undercurrent of grim determination.
"Forgive me," said Nasuwada. "I have had a trying morning. If my thoughts wander over much, please bear with me."
Sapphira blinked again.
"What is it that has stirred up the Varden so? A group of men roused me from my sleep with their ill-tempered wrangling, and before that I heard an unusual number of messengers racing through the camp."
Pressing her lips together, Nasuwada turned away from Sapphira and crossed her arms, cradling her healing forearms with cupped hands. The colouring of her mind became black as a midnight cloud, full of intimations of death and violence. After an uncharacteristically long pause, she said,
"One of the Varden, a man by the name of Othmund, crept into the Urgal's camp last night and killed three of them while they were asleep around their fire. The Urgals failed to catch Othmund at the time, but this morning he claimed credit for the deed and was boasting of it throughout the army."
"Why did he do this?"
Sapphira asked.
"Did the Urgals kill his family?"
Nasuwada shook her head.
"I almost wish they had, because then the Urgals would not be so upset. Revenge, at least, they understand. No. That's the strange part of this affair. Othmund hates the Urgals for no other reason than they are Urgals. They have never wronged him nor his kin, and yet he loathes Urgals with every fibre of his body. Or so I gather after having spoken with him."
"How will you deal with him?"
Nasuwada looked at Sapphira again, a profound sadness in her eyes.
"He will hang for his crimes. When I accepted the Urgals into the Varden, I decreed that anyone who attacked an Urgal would be punished as if he had attacked a fellow human. I cannot go back on my word now."
"Do you regret your promise?"
"No. The men needed to know I would not condone such acts, otherwise they might have turned against the Urgals the very day Nargajvarg and I made our pact. Now, however, I must show them I meant what I said. If I don't, there will be even more murders,
and then the Urgals will take matters into their own hands, and once again our two races shall be snapping at each other's throats. It is only right Othman should die for killing the Urgals, and for defying my order. But, oh, Saphira, the Varden will not like this. I have sacrificed my own flesh to win their loyalty, but now they will hate me for hanging Othmund. They will hate me for equating the lives of Urgals with the lives of humans.
Lowering her arms, Nasawada tugged at the cuffs of her sleeves.
And I cannot say I like it any more than they will. For all my attempts to treat the Urgals openly and fairly and as equals, as my father would have, I cannot help but remember how they killed him. I cannot help but remember the sight of all those Urgals slaughtering the Varden during the Battle of Farthendur. I cannot help but remember the many stories I heard when I was a child, stories of Urgals sweeping out of the mountains and murdering innocent people in their beds. Always Urgals were the monsters to be feared, and here I have joined our fate with theirs. I cannot help but remember all that, Saphira, and I find myself wondering if I have made the right decision.
You cannot help but be human,
said Saphira, attempting to comfort Nasawada.
Yet you do not have to be bound by what those around you believe. You can grow beyond the limits of your race if you have the will. If the events of the past can teach us anything, it is that the kings and queens and other leaders who have brought the races closer together are the ones who have accomplished the greatest good in Alagazia. It is strife and anger we must guard against, not closer relations with those who were once our foes. Remember your distrust of the Urgals, for they have well earned it. But also remember that once dwarves and dragons loved one another no more than humans and Urgals. And once dragons fought against the elves, and would have driven their race extinct if we could have. Once those things were true, but no more. Because people like you had the courage to set aside past hatreds and forge bonds of friendship where previously none existed.
Nasawada pressed her forehead against the side of Saphira's jaw, then said,
You are very wise, Saphira.
Amused, Saphira lifted her head off her paws and touched Nasawada on the brow with the tip of her snout.
I speak the truth as I see it, no more. If that is wisdom, then you are welcome to it. However, I believe you already possess all the wisdom you need. Executing Othmund may not please the Varden, but it will take more than this to break their devotion to you. Besides, I am sure you can find a way to mollify them.
I,
said Nasawada, wiping the corners of her eyes with her fingers.
I will have to, I think.
Then she smiled, and her face was transformed.
But Othmund was not why I came to see you. Aragorn just contacted me, and asked for you to join him in Farthendur. The dwarves...
Arching her neck, Saphira roared toward the sky, sending the fire from her belly rippling out through her mouth in a flickering sheet of flame. Nasawada staggered back from her, while everyone else within earshot froze and stared at Saphira. Rising to her feet, Saphira shook herself from head to tail, her weariness forgotten, and spread her wings in preparation for flight. Nasawada's guard started toward her, but she waved them back. A patch of smoke swept over her, and she pressed the underside of her sleeve over her nose, coughing.
Your enthusiasm... is commendable, Saphira, but...
Is Aragorn injured or hurt?
Saphira asked. Alarm shot through her when Nasawada hesitated.
He's as healthy as ever, Nasawada replied. However, there was an incident yesterday.
What kind of incident?
He and his guards were attacked. Saphira held herself motionless while Nasawada recalled for her everything Aragorn had said during their conversation. Afterwards, Saphira bared her teeth.
Dur Grimstas Sweldon Rak Arnowin should be grateful I was not with Aragorn. I would not have let them escape so easily for attempting to kill him.
With a small smile, Nasawada said, "For that reason, it is probably better you were here."
"Perhaps," Saphira admitted,
and then released a puff of hot smoke and lashed her tail from side to side.
"It does not surprise me, though. Always this happens. Whenever Aragorn and I part, someone attacks him. It's gotten so it makes my scales itch to let him out of my sight for more than a few hours."
"He's more than capable of defending himself."
"True, but our enemies are not without skill either."
Impatient, Saphira shifted her stance, raising her wings even higher.
"Nasawada, I am eager to be gone. Is there anything else I should know?"
"No," said Nasawada. "Fly swift and fly true, Saphira. But do not tarry when you arrive in Farthendur. As soon as you leave our camp, we shall have only a few days' grace before the Empire realizes I have not sent you and Aragorn on a brief scouting trip. Galbatorix may or may not decide to strike while you are away. But every hour you are absent will increase the possibility. Also, I would much prefer to have the two of you with us when we attack Feinster. We could take the city without you, but it will cost us many more lives. In short, the fate of the entire Varden depends upon your speed."
"We shall be as swift as the storm-driven wind,"
Saphira assured her. Then Nasawada bade her farewell and retreated from the stone slab, whereupon Blodgam and the other elves rushed to Saphira's side and strapped her uncomfortable leather patch Aragorn seat saddle onto her, and filled the saddlebags with the food and equipment she would normally carry if embarking upon a trip with Aragorn. She would not need the supplies, she could not even access them herself, but for the sake of appearances she had to carry them. Once she was ready, Blodgam twisted his hand in front of his chest in the elves' gesture of respect, and said in the ancient language,
"Fare thee well, Saphira Brightscales. May you and Aragorn return to us unharmed."
"Fare thee well, Blodgam."
Saphira waited, while the black-blue wolf-hair elf created a water-shadow ghost of Aragorn, and the apparition walked out of Aragorn's tent and climbed onto her back. She felt nothing as the insubstantial wraith stepped from her left foreleg to the upper part of her leg, and then to her shoulder. When Blodgam nodded to her, indicating the knot Aragorn was in place, she lifted her wings until they touched overhead, then leaped forward off the end of the stone slab. As Saphira fell toward the grey tents below, she drove her wings downward, propelling herself away from the breakbone ground. She turned in the direction of Farthendur and began climbing up to the layer of thin cold air high above, where she hoped to find a steady wind to aid her on her journey. She circled over the wooded riverbank where the Varden had chosen to stop for the night, and wriggled with a fierce joy. No longer did she have to wait while Aragorn went off adventuring without her. No longer would she have to spend the entire night flying over the same patches of land again and again. And no longer would those who wished to hurt her partner of her mind and heart be able to escape her wrath. Opening her jaws, Saphira roared her joy and confidence to the world, daring whatever gods there might be to challenge her. She who was the daughter of Irmunga and Vervada, two of the greatest dragons of their age. When she was more than a mile above the Varden, and a strong southwestern wind was pressing against her, Saphira aligned herself with the torrent of air and allowed it to propel her forward, soaring over the sun-drenched land below. Casting her thoughts out before her, she said,
"I'm on my way!" little one.
Four strokes upon the drum. Aragorn leaned forward, every muscle in his body tense, as the white-haired dwarf woman Hadfala, chief of Durgrimst Ebardok, rose from the table where the clanmeet was gathered, and uttered a short line in her native language. Murmuring into Aragorn's left ear, Hundfast translated,
"On behalf of mine clan, I vote for Grimst Borith Oric as our new king."
Aragorn released his pent-up breath.
One.
In order to become ruler of the dwarves, a clan chief had to win a majority of the votes from the other chiefs. If none achieved that feat, then according to dwarvish law, the clan chief with the least votes would be eliminated from the competition, and the meet could adjourn for up to 3 days before voting again. The process would continue as needed until a clan chief had achieved the necessary majority, at which point the meet would swear fealty to him or her as their new monarch. Considering how pressed for time the Varden were, Aragorn fervently hoped that the voting would not require more than one round, and if it did, that the dwarves would not insist upon taking a recess of more than a few hours. If that happened, he thought he might break the stone table in the center of the room out of frustration. That Hadfala, the first clan chief to vote, had cast her lot with Oric, boded well. Hadfala, as Aragorn knew, had been backing Ganel of Durgrimst Quan before the attempt on Aragorn's life. If Hadfala's allegiances had shifted, then it was also possible that the other member of Ganel's cohort, namely Grimst Borith Undin, might also give his vote to Oric. Next, Galdhim of Durgrimst Feldunost rose from the table. Although he was so short, he was taller sitting than he was standing.
"On behalf of mine clan," he declared, "I vote for Grimst Borith Nardo as our new king."
Turning his head to one side, Oric looked back at Aragorn and said to him in an undertone,
"Well, that was as we expected."
Aragorn nodded and glanced over at Nardo. The round-faced dwarf was stroking the end of his yellow beard, appearing pleased with himself. Then Manandrath of Durgrimst Ledwonu said,
"On behalf of mine clan, I vote for Grimst Borith Oric as our new king."
Oric nodded toward him in thanks, and Manandrath nodded in return, the tip of his long nose bobbing. As Manandrath sat, Aragorn and everyone else looked at Ganel, and the room became so quiet Aragorn could not even hear the dwarves breathing. As chief of the religious clan, the Quan, and the high priest of Gunterra, king of the dwarf gods, Ganel carried enormous influence among his race. However he chose, so the crown was likely to go.
"On behalf of mine clan," Ganel said, "I vote for Grimst Borith Nardo as our new king."
A wave of soft exclamations broke out among the dwarves watching from the perimeter of the circular room, and Nardo's pleased expression broadened. Clenching his interlaced hands, Aragorn silently cursed.
"Don't give up hope yet, lad,"
Oric muttered.
"We may yet pull through. It's happened before that the Grimst Borith of the Quan has lost the vote."
"How often does it happen, though?" whispered Aragorn.
"Often enough."
"When did it last happen?" Oric shifted and glanced away.
824 years ago, when Queen..."
He fell silent as Undin of Durgrimst Ragni Heftin proclaimed,
"On behalf of mine clan, I vote for Grimst Borith Nardo as our new king."
Oric crossed his arms. Aragorn could only see his face from the side, but it was obvious that Oric was scowling. Biting the inside of his cheek, Aragorn stared at the patterned floor, counting the votes that had been cast as well as those that remained, trying to determine if Oric could still win the election. Even in the best of circumstances, it would be a close thing. Aragorn tightened his grip, his fingernails digging into the back of his hands. Thordris of Durgrimst Nagra stood and draped her long, thick braid over one arm.
On behalf of mine...